This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Open for business on BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station. Welcome to Open for Business here on Enterprise. My name is Rich Bradbury. In the studio with me right now, I have Francisca Turner-Shaikh, better known as Frankie, the lead lady from Frankitas. How would you describe it, Frankie?
How would you describe Frankitas?
Yeah.
Right. So we are actually we're a lifestyle brand and not so much, I think people see us as a fashion brand, but I'd like to think that we're more than just a fashion brand. We're a lifestyle brand just because of our business ethos, and we look at things slightly differently than, you know, your normal business model. We started Frankitas almost 6 years ago, and it was in my house, obviously. That's where most businesses start with us ladies, as a wife and a mother of three children. So I started when my children was, you know, when they were all in school and in kindergarten and nursery, which left me some time, obviously, to myself. And I'd been in corporate for the longest time, and I decided to give that up because I wanted to raise my children. But I think once you've been in the corporate world, once you've had that taste of career and work, I think you'll always go back to it at some point, whether it's full-time or part-time. But I've always had a love interest with textile, specifically traditional textile, just because I'm half Indonesian and half English, but I was brought up in Indonesia in a village in West Java. And, you know, we're well known for our batik. We're also just well known in general for traditional textiles like batik, songket, and ikat.
Yeah.
And growing up, you know, I've always collected these traditional fabric, more so batik than ikat. I think ikat was a little bit more... we use a lot of ikat for home decor instead of fashion. But coming back to how Frankitas started was, again, after my children was sort of settled, and I had all these textile in a box, and I decided to take them out instead of it collecting dust and with humidity and everything, with mold. And I started cutting them up with my aunt together. My aunt is here in Malaysia, and she's married a Malaysian as well. I'm married to a Malaysian. And so we decided to make them into clutches because it's the easiest thing to do. And, you know, every woman does love a good clutch, right? We all need a good clutch. And so we did. We cut them up, and then we started sewing them, and we made about 15 to 20 clutches, and then we sold them at flea markets, artisanal market. The first one we did was in BSC, and we did very, very well. And I thought, great, we'll make more. So we made more and more. We did a few more markets, which led me to think, I think we are probably on to something. But then, you know, my bedroom, my house then started filling up with a lot of raw materials, buttons and zippers.
You had stuff everywhere.
I had stuff everywhere, and the husband was getting a little bit grumpy, and he thinks, listen, you know, we might be in trouble, so do you mind taking this somewhere else, please? I'd suggest that if you want to do this, you know, like a lot more seriously, do it properly.
Right.
And, you know, when you're a mom of three children and you're running a household, yes, you know, people like your things, but you question yourself, right? And you think, can I really make this sort of commitment? Taking it outside of the house means it's very, very serious. It means you have to find a place.
And it's no longer a hobby.
It's no longer a hobby. Mm. And it's no longer of, you know, your mental state of mind thinking, you know, am I just the mother of three children? Am I just the wife? You know, I used to have a career. Maybe I'll do something to not only pass my time, but sort of prove to yourself that you are something else outside than a mother and a wife. Mm. I mean, not everybody thinks like that, but I know quite a few people who have had career who've gone through the same sort of mental process. And I think it was a good thing that hubby got grumpy, because that sort of pushed me over the edge, and I decided to commit. And I think that was the first step, the commitment, the mental commitment to say, okay, I'm just going to jump in. I decided to rent a house in Damansara Heights, just because it's, you know, for the practical side of things, my children, they go to school just around the neighborhood. It's a 5 minutes walk. And I thought, this house is available for rent and it seems perfect. And I didn't want to be in a mall, or malls are a little bit cold, and then, you know, the opening time and closing time is a little bit more rigid, and I wasn't ready for that. I wanted to create something that's very, very homely, quite organic, somewhere that reminds me of my home, you know, and people's homes. And so I took the plunge and I rented this place out in Damansara Heights. That was 5 years ago.
When you did this, when you were selling your stuff over at BSC, was it just like a pop-up kind of thing?
Yes.
Was it an artisanal sale?
Yeah.
So over the years, you know, you kind of, where I'm from, artisanal stores are like these places. There's three or four of them perhaps in every hometown, and they're buying stuff from Bali and, you know, places like that. I mean, how different is it to try and sell that kind of stuff here in Malaysia, where it's not so unfamiliar?
Yeah.
How difficult is it to find a market for it?
Actually, if 6 years ago, it would be more difficult to find the variety of artisanal, inverted comma, market than it is now. I think everywhere you go, every malls you go to, every email, every day I get an email or an Instagram message asking me or asking Franquitas to participate in artisanal markets.
Yeah.
So the word artisanal is yet
it's
to really...
It's banded around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's lost its authenticity, I think.
Yeah.
I think most people think that artisanal... They still think that artisanal is buying a product from Bali or India or wherever it is and sort of labeling it themselves and then calling it artisanal.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see artisanal being that way.
Mm. How do you see it?
I think it's authenticity, you know, and it has to kind of be organic.
And not mass-produced.
Well, definitely not mass-produced. It's the complete opposite of mass-produced. Mm. And I think the first step is designing your own product genuinely. And it has to come from you. It can't come from anyone else or a producer. Mm. So that's the first step, is you designing it and then making it with your bag maker or your clothing, your tailor, for example. I think that is the true essence of artisan. The fact that the idea and the design comes from you and you work with different communities, whether they're tailors or bag makers or shoemakers around you, and not taking it to big places like China and mass producing them.
Mm.
So it's the complete opposite of mass production. You can call it the cottage industry.
Yeah.
It's slow fashion at the same time.
Yeah.
So I think it, can I say bastardize in?
Yes, you can.
I can?
Yeah.
Okay. I think the word has been bastardized, completely bastardized.
Mm.
It's a beautiful word, artisanal, but again,
It's become one of those categories that, and I say this in inverted commas, has been adopted for stuff that tends to be or used to be handcrafted perhaps in a small village somewhere and has been copied and then mass-produced elsewhere and sold elsewhere as, again, artisanal, when really the majority of it nowadays is not.
Yeah.
And I think the beauty of something like what you're doing with the smaller batches and the very individual designs is mm-hmm. something that, you know, it is less visible. And I think it's one of those, it really is one of those few things that you can look at now, and they're individual pieces. Each one of them is an individual piece.
That's right.
With that being said, how do you go about sourcing your material, finding the people to work on these bags and other creations that you have, mm-hmm. you know, and still remain and retain that high level of authenticity? Because it must be, I suspect, a fairly expensive process to find somebody yeah. who puts that amount of hard work into it.
Yeah, it is. It's not just expensive, but it's time consuming.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of I always joke to my friends. I said, you know, that's why I will never be rich. Because to be rich, you need to, in this business anyway, if you call it the fashion industry, you would have to make things in volumes, right? That's where the money is. But we just don't have that kind of capacity from so many different elements. One, the finance, two, the human resource element. Like, we don't have enough crafters here in Malaysia, unfortunately. You know, Malaysians are very talented, very, very creative, especially the Malay. The Malays are extraordinarily creative. But the younger ones don't want to be in that industry. They want to work for the tech industry. They want to work for the high fashion and the fast fashion industry because, you know, the brand name carries a lot of weight to, you know, their Instagram right. account yep. and their social status, yep. but as well as the financial support that they're getting. Whereas an industry like ours, it's long hours and it's quite intensive. If you look at a weaver's life and if that's the only thing that they do, they could be weaving 8 to 12 hours a day and it's just weave after weave after weave. I mean, do you think you can do that all day?
No, I know I can't do that all day.
Yeah.
I've seen it. I traveled to Guizhou to see some of the work that the ladies did there and some of the material that they lived there. Not only are they weaving it, they're then pounding it with a hammer for days on end to make it shiny.
Yeah.
And then leaving it out in the sun for a long time.
Yeah.
And the materials that they made, they were beautiful, you know.
Yeah.
And it was this black, shiny material that I'd never, ever seen before, almost like the back of a beetle.
Wow.
And when you speak to these ladies who've been making it their entire lives and their hands and their fingers yeah. are all kind of misshapen, and you ask, how long did it take you to make that jacket? And they say, 15 weeks.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of, wow, that's that moment when you think, well, that industry has pretty much died a death and there's only these yeah. few remaining enclaves
yeah.
still doing it.
Yeah.
On that note, let's take a break.
Sure.
We'll come back in a few moments. I'm speaking with Frankie. She is the founder and creative director of Frankie Tass. We'll be back in just a few moments here on Open for Business on Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Busy following Money Trail, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station. This is Open for Business. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm in the studio with Frankie Turner from Frankie Tass. We were speaking a little bit before the break about the idea of artisanal and what that means in kind of today's day and age. Obviously, how things have changed over the last few years. With that in mind, let's kind of rewind a little bit mm-hmm. before we move on to the future about the past and how you decided to fund a business like mm-hmm. this. I mean, as we just discussed, finding these people who still make traditional garments in a traditional manner is not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And founding a business from ground upwards is not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the funding come from?
Well, I think it helped the fact that I was in corporate and I had a little bit of savings.
Mm.
And I used that savings to really invest in my business. I mean, for the last 6 years, to be honest, Richard, it's just been me funding the business.
Yeah.
And it's years of savings and it's years of rolling the profit back right. into the business yeah. and trying to scale up and trying to expand the brand name and expand the capacity development side of the production. It's that, and I think that, again, if you talk about entrepreneurship, is always the main struggle.
Right.
It's the finance.
Yeah.
Right? And if you want to scale up in so many different ways, you need the funds.
Mm.
And I think in the last five years, I've been quite... I'm a bit of a romantic, if you can call it like that. I believe that, you know, if you wanna succeed, you put in the effort, you work hard, you strategize, and the result will come, and the money will come. And I think the money never really, really came. Mm-hmm. And it's just, again, reinvesting in the profits. But how much profit can you make from having a small production, right? So this year, end of last year, I realized that I think perhaps it would be a good idea to have an investor, since this is a show called Open for Business.
Yeah.
I think Franquitas, I can confidently say that we are very much open for business. We are very much open to potential investors looking into our business. But when I say that, I take that with a pinch of salt. I think we're looking for a special kind of investor. You know, again, I am trying to manage expectations here from an investor's perspective. I'm not going to make you a very, very rich man or woman by investing into the business. But what you are investing in is a brand that chooses to be ethical, the best I can be. Mm. And is to create a community of weavers, and I want to marry, you know, the Asian heritage. I want to marry by introducing different traditional textiles from all over Asia, and I want to highlight these weavers, and I want to give them a platform to speak on their behalf. And communicating through their work, because, you know, we talked about it. It's a long process and it's highly intensive. What they're doing is an art form.
Mm.
It is art,
mm.
but, you know, it's just not auctioned at Christie's.
Mm.
But it's the artisanal and it's the cottage industry that are supporting them. I believe that businesses should be sustainable. I think it's the only way to do it, especially now, more than ever. I mean, we've seen the amount of crap that's going on in the entire world with diseases and climate change. And I mean, the list goes on, right?
Mm.
And surely that is a message
mm.
for all of us. Mm. Surely.
Fast fashion, I think, has had its moment in the sun. And I think more and more people are awakening to the fact that as to how damaging it is for the environment
yeah.
and how much of an impact it has on our daily lives, you know, and how much of the stuff that you buy from the big brands essentially gets worn 3 or 4 times and then yeah. gets thrown away,
yeah.
you know, whereas you may have something that's been hand-produced somewhere
yeah.
and it will last a very long time.
That's right.
And often becomes something like you were unpacking the material at the beginning of this story.
That's right.
As a hand-me-down, as something that you romanticize over, yeah. you know, and it creates a memory.
That's right.
And we don't have that anymore.
No, we don't.
With that, some of the materials that you choose,
mm-hmm.
How do you choose them? You know, what is for you the ideal material? You spoke about batik.
Yeah.
You also work with ikat and, yes. and a few of the bits and pieces.
Yes.
I know ikat is a big thing in Uzbekistan, I believe. There. For you, though, how do you look at something and determine beauty of fabric? What makes it stand out for you?
I think the colors and the motives, I mean, that's the first thing that you look at,
mm.
right?
Mm.
But then once you pass that, you know, the vibrancy of the colors and the motifs, and you dig deeper, knowing the process to produce such beautiful, beautiful pieces. Ikat, for an example, I have a soft spot for Ikat, just because of the technique that's used. It's an ancient technique that was done a long, long, long time ago. Mm. And it was only the royalties that could have them, because it was very dear to make them. Mm. The proper traditional ancient technique, Ikat, is a 9-to-12-step process. You know, from the tying, from the marking, the tying, the untying, the dyeing, the drying, and then, you know, and then the weaving, and then the washing, and then the drying again.
Mm.
You know, it's a lot of process. Mm. It's a lot of process. For me, that alone is just incredible. So I have a huge amount of respect for the men and the women doing that. So that's how I judge the beauty of any fabric, you know, not just aesthetically, but then I always research and dig deeper. Where does it come from? Who made it? How is it made?
Mm.
Did they use or a plant-based dye, or was there a chemical in this? Was it done just by a traditional loom? Who are these women? I find the stories that is the selling point for me. Really, I'm touched by the stories.
Mm.
And I think that comes from, you know, I was raised in a village in Indonesia for 9 years. And, you know, the saying, it takes a village to raise a child. I really was a product of that child. The amount of times I go back to that village and, you know, my neighbors saying, "You know, do you remember me breastfeeding you?" And I'm like, "No, I don't." But you know, there was quite a few women who breastfed me in the village, and everybody looked out for each other, and not just the children, but you know, the single mother who've lost their husbands, and that's village life.
Mm.
It's very, very community driven, and that's how I see things in Franquitas and business in general. You have to look after the people that you work with. You have to look after the community for the community to look after you. And for me, that is sustainability on top of the environmental factor, of course, caring for nature and not destroying for nature. That's how I see things, if that makes sense.
It does. Now, when I was looking through your website, I noticed you've got stores or outlets in Malaysia, Singapore, the US, Maldives, Japan, Spain.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see, or what do you see Franquitas doing within the next 2 or 3 years? I mean, you've already spoken about investment, or a particular type of investor.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you want it to go? What do you want to happen over the next couple of years?
I want Franquitas, as much as it is to be a sustainable business, of course, you know, I have to be very, very practical and not just romanticize things.
Would it bother you if somebody came in and said to you, "Look, we love the ideas, we love the designs, can we take them somewhere else for production?" Would that bother you?
I guess it depends where and how it's done and who's doing it. Whoever I'm going to work with has to really care about, it has to have some impact. And the impact isn't just self-serving. It has to impact others. And that is our biggest ethos. So if you ask me where we see ourselves in the next 5 to 10 years, we see ourselves as a very proud Malaysian brand, lifestyle brand, who cares for its community. And yes, we want to expand and be in all over the, of course, I want to be all over the place. But I would love for production to be here in Malaysia, if I can help it. Just because there's, you know, a reduction of carbon footprint and you are supporting the local community of crafters. The challenge with that is, as I said at the beginning, we don't really have many crafters. So again, that is the challenge, to find the bag makers, to find the weavers in Malaysia. You know, there are a few organizations right now who are actually trying to revive traditional textile, you know, like, for example, Songket Terengganu. The Queen has her own project, and I think it's a fantastic project. Mm. And I'd love to see more of that. You know, if that happens in a bigger way, I think we can preserve and we can save the industry. I was just having a conversation yesterday with one of our textile supplier, Alan, a little man from the Isle of Wight who now resides in Phnom Penh. And he came out there about 12 years ago and he worked for Fair Trade and he sort of set it all up. And he now works with hundreds of weavers all over Cambodia. And what he does is that he supplies, you know, the raw materials, and he provides all the equipment for his weavers to be able to produce the amazing quality. And now some of these weavers are predominantly victims of either landmines or have polio. So they are physically at a disadvantage. And the fact that he looks after their needs, pays them fairly, I mean, I just love that. If we can have that here, and if we can replicate that around Asia and all over the world, I think it would be phenomenal. Mm. Alan and I talked about being romantic and being real and being optimistic and about the future of slow fashion and fast fashion. The real question is slow fashion ever going to win versus fast fashion? And, you know, his answer is, well, realistically, no, never. And it's because of choices, right? Some people, the mass population of the world, can't afford to buy the things that I produce because they're at a, you know, at a higher price range because of all of our production needs, right? Versus bigger brands that provide very cheap clothing, t-shirts for like a dollar or two, yeah. Yeah. You know, but at the same time, months later, you're going to have holes. But the predominant population who can afford that, they don't really care. Well, they don't really, it's not that they don't care, but they have no choice. They don't have that choice. Mm. So what is my message in all of this is that I think when you have a choice, the people that have a choice all over the world, and when you can afford it, I'd suggest that you buy into investment pieces. You buy into not just the aesthetics of the product, but you buy into the story and who made them. That's the message. And again, you know, I'm sort of jumping around a little bit, coming back to the future of Franquitas. We'd like to be a conscious brand, not just making our own things, but we want to work with different organizations, whether they're for-profit or non-profit. And we kind of want to impact different lives and communities. For example, right now we work very, very closely with, you know, the Fuji School.
Yeah.
The school's been around for 10 years, and what they've done is phenomenal. Mm. You know, they've been providing free education for the last 10 years for refugee children in KL, hundreds of them. You know, some of them have been relocated, but most of them are still here with no access to basic education. That just seems so wrong, that a child has no access to, you know, education. Mm. So we've been working with them for the last 3 years now. And Deborah Henry has asked for us to help out a little bit with the school, as well as their business entity. They have, I don't know if you know this, but they created a business unit for the Fuji School. It's called Fujila.
Fujila.
Yeah. Mm. And so they make their own jewelry. The children from the school make every piece that they make, and all the profit, and they get paid for it. And all the profit goes back to running of the school. For me, that's a fantastic business model. So Franquitas has been, so they make the jewelries in our shop upstairs. We've provided them a room. The girls come over, and Deborah's sister and I, we've been teaching the girls how to make the pieces. They also learn how to market and sell the products and not just make them. And hopefully one day they can take over the business, you know. So we want to work with people that want to work with us. And, you know, for the Fuji Lab business model, I've sort of replicated the Franquitas business model. So we've called up all of our distributors worldwide to say, hey, there's this brand that complements what we do, and this is the story. Would you like to buy it? And they've all said yes. This means that this business model works. And so we'd like to do a little bit more of that, whether it's working with a refugee community or whether it's working with orphanage or a single mother, not just in Malaysia, but in Indonesia, all over. So we want to be impact-driven brand all over the world.
Frankie, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Richard.
This has been Open for Business here on Enterprise on BFM 89.9, the business station.
You've been listening to Open for Business on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.